Welcome to the November 30th, 2012 Jupilize Me podcast. Jupilize Me. So, welcome to the Jupilize Me podcast, where we talk about all things Drupal, and it comes out every other Friday. I am Addison Berry, and today I have a small panel of folks with me. I have Seth Brown, who is Seth L. Brown on Drupal.org, and he is the Director of Operations here at Lullabot.
Say hello. Good day.
I am also here with Jared Bittner, who is known on Drupal.org as Circuitry, but not spelled the way that you think.
And greetings.
He is a senior technical project manager here at Lullabot as well. And then I also have Matthew Saunders, who is Matthew S. on Drupal.org. He is the COO of Five Rings Web and principal of Vintage Digital.
Hi, pleased to be here.
And last but not least, we have Drew Hartfield, who is the Vice President of Digital Operations at Martha Stewart Living Omnimedia. He is also known as the Grand Poobah.
At least to myself, yes, thank you.
And at least to those of us on this call. So why I have gathered these fine people together today is to talk about project management in Drupal. Well, project management generally, and sort of like what that whole sticky kind of gray topic is for a lot of people, and then also how that relates specifically when you're working within Drupal projects. And so we're going to talk about a whole bunch of things. I have, I think, some interesting questions lined up. We have some questions from folks out on the intertubes. Before we dive into that conversation, though, I want to just do a little bit of Drupal news. In terms of Drupalize Me, we've put out new videos on the command line and Uyala, which is a video delivery service provider. So those are free videos that just came out this Wednesday. And then next week, we're going to have a whole new series of starting up on coding for Drush. So that's going to teach you how to basically create your own custom Drush commands and what all those pieces are and how they work. Also taking a look at Drush makefiles. In terms of Drupal stuff, there's a pretty big announcement that happened this week, and that is that the Drupal 8 release cycle has been extended. So, the way that it got extended, because feature freeze has already been scheduled for this weekend, the beginning of December, and the way that that Dries and the core maintainers have extended this is by adding a new phase. So there used to be feature freeze, and then we would go directly to code freeze, but now there's a new thing called the feature cleanup phase, which will go from basically now until February 18th, which will be just after DrupalCon Sydney. And now code freeze has been moved forward to July 1st. And there's mystically no specific date now targeted for the release of Drupal 8, of course. And generally, there is never a specific date because a release can't be done until all the critical bugs have been quashed. So anyway, that's pretty big news. I don't think it's terribly shocking to a lot of people. There's a lot going on in Drupal 8, and the fact that we've extended the release cycle again is probably not new news to anybody who's been involved. Events coming up, a whole bunch of events. We have Drupal Camp Ohio, which is in Columbus, Ohio. It is today, Friday, and tomorrow, Saturday. Lullabot is a sponsor there. Jeff Robbins of Lullabot is going to be keynoting, and there are a number of other bots who are going to be attending. So go, you know, find a friendly face and say hi. There's Drupal Day in Rome, Italy this weekend, Drupal Camp Oslo in Norway, and the Oxford Drupal Hack in Oxford, UK. Next weekend is the Drupal Balkan Summit in Zagreb, Croatia, and also Drupal Camp Delhi in India. And then coming up soon, not too far after that, is going to be Drupal Camp Mumbai in India, and then Drupal Rally Minsk in Belarus. So lots of events still happening as we head into the end of the year. I also want to mention real quickly that we are taking part in the Drupal Global Training Day on December 14th. So this is free or low-cost introductory Drupal training all around the world. You can find out more about that at drupal.org/learn-drupal. And Drupalize Me will be providing a half day of online training for a session called What is Drupal? So you can find out more and get links from the drupal.org page on that. And then also, we haven't really talked about this much on the podcast, but DrupalCon Sydney is coming up. It's about 2 months away now. It's February 6th through 9th, and there have been tweets going around this week that they're almost sold out of tickets. So if you want to go, you need to get your ticket soon or you're not going to be able to get in. The schedule is already up. Myself and Jeff Eaton from Mullabot are going to be featured speakers, and we are also doing a full-day workshop there called Real World Drupal, which will basically be looking at what really goes on when you have a Drupal project, from looking at it and trying to break things down and architecting it, making estimations, all the way up to like what's your launch day checklist and what things should you do all in between all of those to make sure that launch day doesn't blow up in your face. So you can find out more about that on the DrupalCon Sydney website, which is sydney2013.drupal.org/training. And we're also going to be doing our community tools workshop on the sprint day, which is on Saturday. And that's just a free 3 or 4 hour workshop on the Saturday morning to get people who want to contribute and be part of the sprint and sort of get you up and running with all the tools that you're going to need in order to do that and feel comfortable with it. So that's open to everybody. You don't need a ticket for DrupalCon or anything. You don't need to sign up in advance. You just need to show up at the sprint, and people will help you out and get you up and running. So definitely check that out, even if you're not going to come to the conference itself. Yeah, that's a whole bunch of stuff. So let's talk project management. I have 4 total project management nerds on the line. Let's start off with, I would like to get a definition of what exactly is project management and why would anybody care? Drew, do you want to take a shot at that one?
Sure. My friend and colleague, Seth Brown, likes to talk about project management as being able to see the future. And we as humans aren't so good at seeing the future. So we've cobbled together a bunch of tools and techniques that help us to look at the past, look at the scope of work in question, and see if we can divine some understanding of how the future is going to go for us. And project managers are people who swim in that every day, try and figure out where are we today and where are we headed and what can I do to keep us headed the right direction. That's pretty much the discipline.
It sounds very simple when you say that. I guess it's where does the rubber meet the road though, right? So what does that mean in terms of like reality? Like what do you do in your day when you put on you go to work and you're like, I'm here and I put on my project management hat? Like, what is it that you're actually, technically sitting down and doing?
Sure. It really breaks down to 2 major buckets. There's a bucket that's all about planning, which is a lot of analysis, gathering information, determining how we plan to get from where we are to where we're going. And the other bucket is about monitoring. What's the health of the process so far? What's the health of the code base? How about the team? A lot of what we do is just trying to help specialists who are used to operating in their own language, their own area of expertise, help them communicate with the other members of the team with whom they have to collaborate for us all to be successful. So there's some bit of shuttle diplomacy. And in project management, we refer to those as the hard skills and the soft skills. The hard skills are the timelines and issue lists and Gantt charts and budget tracking tools, and the soft skills are the shuttle diplomacy, the walking around, making sure that all of the team members are leaning forward into the work instead of leaning back from it.
Right on. So you're saying it's not just having a spreadsheet?
No, there's a whole soft part of it as well.
Right on. So one of the things that I think, well, I sort of wonder, what are the actual like lines? So when it comes to, I think often in a project, there's sort of this thing about there's a project manager, there are developers and designers, you know, who are trying to pull things together. And so I'm wondering, like, I don't know, Seth, can you speak a little bit to like where are the where are those lines in terms of how much the project manager controls versus how much the rest of the team or the whole team together controls?
Sure. I think project managers are always a mile wide and an inch deep, and they're facilitators. They're sort of making things happen, to use the phrase that Scott Burke entitled his very excellent summary of project management with. And I think one of the challenges of being a PM is figuring out where your authority lies and also how much knowledge you need to have about the process or the project that you're managing. And it's always a fine line. You don't want to necessarily get much deeper. You want to be a mile wide. You want to sort of have your finger on the pulse of everything that's happening. And for me, one of the temptations all the time as a PM is to get really curious about a particular technical skill or a project rabbit hole and to want to just sort of go in and immerse myself in that. And you have to sort of step back and realize, you know, that that's not a good use of your time. You have to stay abreast of everything that's happening across the whole project. And so as tempting as it is to sit down and, you know, parse through an API, for instance, that you're going to be working with on your project, you have to recognize that's not your job and not a good use of your time. So with that, you also have to surrender some authority because the people on your project are the people that are going to really know what's going on, and you're going to have to trust them and defer to them, often to make decisions, hopefully in conversation with you. But that can be kind of a scary thing. It's sort of like, I definitely believe that it's helpful to be technical as a project manager. But at the end of the day, those skills atrophy to some degree. Like even if you were a programmer to begin with, as you get into project management, as I did, I went from programming to project management, those skills sort of atrophy. And so you really have to have a lot of trust, and you have to recognize that it's more about facilitating and empowering your team to make decisions than it is about making the decisions yourself.
Right on. So how, of the folks we have here, how many of you have a programming background before you got to becoming a project manager?
I do.
What
about
you,
Seth? And I think Jared and Matt do as well. Drew, I don't know. Were you a programmer before you became a project manager?
No, I was a graphic designer. Not even close.
And while I can read code and I can write it a little bit, that wasn't my central focus. My central focus actually before coming to technology was technical theater. And what I will say is that working in technical theater, particularly when you're doing stage management, is very similar to the discipline of project management in terms of facilitating folks to be able to do the jobs that they need to do to end up with concrete product at the end of the process. But I fell into technology really quite by accident.
What about you, Jared?
I've been a developer for many years, actually, and it wasn't until I was a lead on a project and found that there was kind of a gap in the organizational aspect of it that I found that I had some of these skills. And I think those main core skills are really just good organization skills and good communication skills. And if you can empathize with the different parties and you can organize and you can communicate, you pretty much have what it takes. I'm still learning a lot of the skills of, you know, trying to project budgets and a lot of the technical skills. I joke around with my wife that I've traded my text editor in for a spreadsheet, which is not always so great. I still like to program a lot, and it's a little challenging, especially when I hear Seth say, "Oh, those skills are going to atrophy." I'm like, no. So I keep still do a lot of coding on the side in other things, but yeah, it's definitely a challenge to kind of make that switch mentally as well.
Yeah, I have a similar experience. I've also done coding. I don't do as much project management as you guys do, but I have definitely had to do some project management, and I enjoy it immensely. But it's like a completely different way of approaching tickets and problems than when you're just like, oh, right, I know how to fix that. It's like, no. That's not what we're doing here. It's kind of easy to get caught in the weeds rather than keeping that high-level view of moving everything forward.
Very much. Yeah, we're just working on a project where there's like all these APIs that we're ingesting all this data, and I want to dive into it. I want to understand the scheme, and it's just like, now I gotta step back. I gotta let the guys handle this because, I mean, I got other projects I gotta manage. I just simply don't have the time.
I completely agree with that sentiment. What Seth was saying about people falling into project management. I don't know too many people who were officially trained as project managers. I think they're all like us. They're sort of the unwashed minions from other parts of the business who saw a need and started to fill it and felt comfortable there and said, wow, this is a way that I can really add value outside of the work that I was doing before, whether it be design work like me or coding like some of you guys. I think that that's one of the beauties of being a project manager. We're a little bit the jack of all trades, and that gives us the context, or I think the term that was used before was the compassion, to be able to join those different groups of people together who, without us, probably wouldn't be able to communicate successfully. That's the part that feels really good, when you can make them make the connection and know that you're able to get something built because of that.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think one of the things that I find the most satisfying is when I'm in the process of communicating and translating and mediating between the different parties, and particularly with my work with Examiner.com, where I was, you know, working with everybody from junior developers right up to folks on the executive committee and the board of directors. There was a real need to be able to express to all the different parties the same kind of information, but in different ways that made sense to them, that the context made sense and allowed the entire team to come together to work towards a single goal.
So speaking of the good feeling and the successful part, Matthew, do you want to take a stab, the first stab, at what are the most common challenges to a successful project, and how do you overcome those or work through those?
Sure. I mean, in my experience, failed projects are due to really four things, maybe five. The first is a lack of planning, and there's a tremendous urge to jump into the work and just get it done because you have a sense of the way it should be done. But if you don't spend the time measuring your board, so to speak, and doing it twice before cutting it, you'll fall into real troubles. The second is communication. When communication goes awry and people aren't expressing themselves in the most effective way, you can have some really wonky things occur in terms of what's delivered to you from the developer or what the expectation was from the product person or from the client. And that particularly can be challenging for our community because our teams are often not all native speakers of the same language. Our teams often work in English, but English may be the second language or third language for a good chunk of the team. I think the third thing that can cause projects to fall apart is a lack of process and not adhering in a disciplined way to a process, and thinking that you can just skirt around one portion of your process, or even worse, not having a process at all. And I think the final thing that I've seen that has that's caused projects to sort of fall apart and fail is differences in culture. And that isn't just sort of the notion of country culture, but it's also culture of the group of people that individuals sort of hang with. Developers have a very specific culture that's different even a little bit than themers, which is different than project managers, which can be completely different than what a client would expect, what your stakeholders would expect. So a good chunk of what you end up having to do is bridge those cultures and act as a translator between them. So, you know, I like to think communication, translation, mediation, those are three skills that are critical to keeping projects from failing and having successful outcomes.
Hey, if I could just jump in, I love that list of four. That's a golden list. Your number two, you mentioned communication, and I referred to that earlier as well. I think when we talk about communication, we think about sort of the soft, fuzzy, making people understand each other and make sure everyone's needs are being taken care of. But some of it is simple, basic syntax. We spend a lot of time here at Martha Stewart just being sure that when I talk about a template or when I talk about a module or a widget, does it mean the same thing to me that it does to you? And I've worked in many different industries outside of publishing and media. It's incredible sometimes to sit in meetings with people from those different cultural backgrounds and listen to them for 40 minutes, have a conversation, and not realize that the item, the nugget that they're speaking about isn't even commonly understood. That we're talking all about widgets, and what I think are widgets aren't what you think are widgets. And yet it's a half an hour later and we still haven't realized that, because we're all doing a lot of talking and not so much listening. So there's the soft, fuzzy side of communication. There's also the hardcore, just things like syntax and semantics that need to be taken into account.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, when you talk to anybody in the web world about a module, except for people in Drupal, they think of a block, right? So it's really important to sit down at the beginning of a project and make sure that the entire team, right from the stakeholder or the client down to the most junior developer, using the same vernacular or using the same language. And they're very clear on what those pieces mean within that vernacular. You're dead on. I've seen the exact same thing.
Well, so with that, in terms of we've, you know, mentioned a few times, like in terms of, yeah, within Drupal and within this, you know, community and stuff like that, what about Drupal or doing project management, working on Drupal projects is different than, say, other web technology? Like, what other challenges or benefits are there around working with Drupal?
Well, you know, I used to work before I came to Drupal in 2007. I worked for 8.5 years building custom PHP MySQL applications. And the process of planning at the beginning was quite different than the process of planning a Drupal project. And the reason that I say that is that we would go through the entire feature list of a given project, and we would approach it entirely from the ground up and plan everything from the ground up. So, you know, you'd have your sort of general idea of what a feature was going to be, and then you'd drill down until you got down to the tiny little details. When I'm starting to plan a Drupal project, my first thing is to take a look at the desired features list and then start scanning our ecosystem for community code that might fit the bill, and figure out whether that community code is good or could be made good, and whether it fits with the client's requirements. And sometimes, you know, you can go to a client and say, hey, such and such a module is going to give you 80% of what you're looking for, and it's going to drop the cost of this chunk of the project by 90%. Is that okay with you? And you know, often the client will agree to that. So it's a different process, because it comes right back to the whole notion of Drupal as a Lego system, where you're taking chunks and you're putting them all together, pre-built, pre develop chunks and fitting them together, and then putting some special sauce around that to glue it all together at the end. So for me, it's a quite different process of planning.
Yeah, there's a number of terms for sort of what I like to think of as rapid prototyping. You know, some people call it the getting real method. Some people call it minimum viable process. You know, there's all kinds of the lean startup is a recent business book that talks a lot about similar methodologies in business. But I think Drupal tends to lend itself to really a more agile process where you sort of can take these Lego building blocks in real time and start to build out real world functionality. Excuse me, I've got a bit of a cold, for your clients. And do it in such a way that it sort of inverts the traditional process of discover, design, develop. Instead, what can happen sometimes is you start with development. When I worked on the Martha Stewart project with Drew, we started out basically prototyping and building different chunks of the project using these building blocks and then showing them off to stakeholders and saying, do we hit the requirements or not? You know, and then going back and changing this or that. And then design would sometimes happen afterwards. So once you had a functioning prototype, then you start the process of making it beautiful, which is obviously a major part of what Martha Stewart does in everything that they do. Drew, do you want to talk a little bit about how that's kind of integrated into your processes or changed your processes at Martha Stewart?
I really do. I agree with Matt that this is the major effect that Drupal's had on our process. And I think we can all agree, at least from a business perspective, especially with the way that Matt postulated it with his client, 80% of the functionality for 90% less cost, that it's a net positive. But it's important to recognize, especially vis-a-vis the earlier part of our conversation here about communication and all the different kinds of people with their different backgrounds, there's a price to be paid as well. And it's something that we've stumbled over here. We're relatively new Drupal users in the last 2.5 or 3 years here. And we still make this mistake every day. We revert to type and we say, hey, there's something new to build. And we erase the whiteboard and we start building from scratch. And it's the sort of dyed-in-the-wool Drupal people here who are always rolling their eyes and saying, wait a minute, let's go to the community and see what's there. It's tough. It's even still tough today. Even though we know that it's for the best for our business, old habits die hard. And as you mentioned, Seth, this is a really hyper-aesthetic enterprise. I've never worked anywhere wherein aesthetics played such an important role, really from Martha's approval all the way on down. And so the design community here has really had to think through the way they do their own work and come to an acceptance that if we're going to be in a rapid prototyping sort of environment, they need to play a different role than they were playing before. It's not a lesser role, but they're involved in a different part of the process, and they're doing something a little bit different. They're pushing the prototypes one direction or another, as opposed to starting with a clean slate and saying, this is what this beautiful thing will look like.
Related to sort of this idea of rapid prototyping and sort of, not exactly putting the cart before horse, but changing sort of the process, how does that affect estimation? And how much, well, so I guess first of all, it's sort of like how much of estimation is part of project management, right? Like how do you see the future? And how does working with Drupal in a project, you know, affect that? And like, how can you do estimation and how does that change with Drupal?
Oh man, estimation is, it's tough, no matter if you're using Drupal or anything else. And our typical methodology, at least at Lullabot, has kind of become a method of getting the developers to do it. They have a lot of different names for it, planning poker, or I don't know, Seth has this big word for it. I can't remember what it is ever.
Sales engineering. Oh, wow. Wideband Delphi estimation.
That's it. Wideband Delphi. I never remember that term. But the process ends up becoming having the developers do it, in that you have, you know, two or three developers sit down with the project manager to go over the requirements for the project, and, you know, item by item, each person estimates what they think is you know, how many hours it's going to take to implement that to their understanding, or they ask for clarity about their understanding of whatever the item is. And we like to do it in a way that they don't see each other's estimates, so it's kind of blind, a blind test. And at the end, we go down through them again, one by one, and reveal them and kind of talk about our assumptions. Well, why does, you know, Angus think that this is going to take 12 hours, but Nate thinks it's going to take 4. You know, maybe there was an assumption in there that one of them had that the other one didn't think of. And in that way, we kind of come to a more accurate estimation of those things. Now, between when it comes to something between Drupal and non-Drupal, the question becomes, is this already built? And if we find a module out there where it is 80%, well, then the estimate, of course, goes down pretty far, depending on what's left. You know, if the 20% that's not actually in that module, you know, we can either have a conversation with the client to say, well, we can get you this far and it's only going to cost you this much, like Matt was saying, or we can, you know, do you really, really need that piece that just isn't quite there? Do we have to build that and then, you know, estimate that piece of it? But it also becomes, you know, one of the considerations that you have to have is how to fit all these things together. You need technical things like access control or whatever. You know, Drupal's good at some things and it's not good at other things. And being able to identify those things, of course, affects your estimates quite a lot. So it would be, you know, it'd be very hard for somebody who just doesn't know Drupal to give accurate estimates. It's hard for people who know Drupal to give accurate estimates. Estimates are just really tough.
Tricky.
Without turning this into a sort of an agile versus waterfall turf war, with estimating, it's really important to recognize that estimating's accuracy requires analysis. Even if it's just analysis where we're sitting around a table puzzling through, well, what's the right way to build this thing? And that's something that project management in the past hasn't always done a great job of understanding, recognizing, accounting for. The think time costs us money too. And there are different project management methodologies. Some of the ones that the more agile or scrum-like ones that Seth was mentioning earlier, one of their key tenets is that we recognize there's a real cost to the estimating process, and we want to limit that cost as much as possible. We don't limit it by estimating without thinking, because our estimates would be inaccurate. We limit it by only estimating the stuff that we know we're going to build. So we limit the scope of our thought to just those 4 or 5 little features that are right in front of us at the moment. And that's a way to help control estimating. Because as Jared pointed out, it's tough no matter how you try and slice it.
Right, so waterfall is terrific if you're building a bridge or a dam where it's really clear what the end result is going to be. And you can typically get those estimates down to, you know, the very last bolt. And they can be quite accurate. But I think that when you're dealing with software development, particularly with websites where clients are going to see things and then say, hey, well, what about this and what about that? It becomes very, very tough to have anything close to a fixed scope. And in fact, I would argue that that in the web development world, the web application world, there is no such thing as fixed scope. I've never had one in 15 years. You need to factor that into your estimation process. And you need to be, again, this comes right back to communication. You need to be very clear with the client when something is tougher or easier than you thought it was going to be and why. And be upfront. So the client has a chance to make decisions based on their own budget. in my estimation world, I use giant spreadsheets, and I talk to developers, themers, and I will go through each of the features that is desired, and we'll put in a high and a low for each of the features, both in terms of design, in terms of ideation of the feature, in terms of development, and in terms of theming. And then there's a percentage that plops on top of that for project management and for QA, which I have as a set percentage. And you'll just go through the entire feature set and put in those highs, lows. And at the end, we will end up with a number that has a range. And I found that the range is pretty good, not perfect, but pretty good. And provided the client doesn't make radical changes in what their scope of work looks like, it tends to work pretty well. I don't like fixed bid. I think that fixed bid is a situation that somebody always gets hurt. Either the client gets hurt or the shop gets hurt. So I try to avoid those kinds of projects as much as I possibly can. What do other people feel about fixed bid?
This is Drew. I'm usually the client side guy, or at least in my current gig I am, and I despise it. I don't know if my CFO would agree, but it becomes really difficult to build a sustainable partnership. For just that reason, someone's always going to get slammed at the end of the fixed bid. I'd much rather work time and materials, but have a strong, transparent relationship in place so that I understand as the project is growing and maybe the scope is changing, I understand what my real costs are.
Yes, just say no to fixed bid.
Yeah, I mean, as DOO of Lullabot, obviously, we end up having to do a lot of fixed bid projects and fixed bid estimation. And at the end of the day, you know, when you have a set of stakeholders or decision makers sort of up in their ivory towers looking down, they don't really care about the details. They care about how long is this going to take and how much is it going to cost me? And they're really uninterested in explanations about why it should be broken up into phases or chunks in order to diminish the risk, or why an iterative rapid prototyping approach might be cheaper. You know, sometimes they don't even care about cheaper. Sometimes they just want to know a number so that they can budget for their year. And unfortunately, that's definitely a reality that we have to confront all the time. And I feel like Drupal is a leg up in that because, you know, we've built so many sites in Drupal that we have the ability to sort of decompose a project using Drupal entities, not the literal entity, the technical entity, but, you know, all of the different stuff that we have available to us, the Legos that sit in the Drupal pile. And that makes it easier, along with our past experience with those Legos, to kind of be fairly accurate. But I think for the time being, it's not going to go away. It's a necessary evil, and you have to have estimation techniques at the ready to handle when clients aren't willing to consider anything other than a fixed bid. I don't love fixed bids. I don't love RFPs. I don't, you know, but at the same time, I don't think they're going away.
Yeah, there's that. So one thing I want us to sort of back up actually a little bit on is because we've mentioned these terms, agile and waterfall and things like that. Does somebody want to give like just a real quick overview of what those terms mean and why we keep throwing them around?
That's funny. No one wants to jump on that one.
Nobody wants to try that.
I was muted.
Go, Matthew, go.
Okay, well, I would say that when you're looking at waterfall, it's highly formalized, focuses on requirements. It typically is inflexible, and planning is front-loaded. So you're doing all your planning up front. You're planning everything out to the nth degree. You're probably going to Gantt chart out the entire project. You're going to have lots and lots of requirements documents. You're likely going to have your artifacts put together up front, like your wireframes and your comps and so forth. And you don't start developing until the entire project is defined. With Agile, it's a little different. You know what your sort of general feature set is going to be, but you don't get into the high level of definition until you reach the particular time box that you're going to work within. So, you know, in Agile shops that I've worked in the past, typically you figure out during this particular time box as a team what you're going to do in the next time box. So you'll be putting together your artifacts and so forth 2 weeks before or a month before, depending on the length of your time box. But you have defined time boxes, and you work with iterative development methods. Tends to be incremental. Requirements and solutions tend to be collaborative instead of being dictated. And the process also allows you to be a little bit more rapid and flexible and responsive to change. And I think one of the critical things is that you're dealing with self-organizing teams as well. And those self-organizing teams mean that the process tends to be a lot flatter than in Waterfall. And by that I mean everybody's helping make the decisions on how you end up developing a given feature.
Right on. Okay. And just real quickly, because we're going to need to wind this down, but I'm just curious, because Agile has definitely been like the new hotness now for a while. Does anybody on this call still work with Waterfall style projects anymore?
Why, yes. Yes, we do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Again, kind of going back to the necessity of fixed bids and the fact that they're not going to go away. We do waterfall projects at times. And again, the key is that all of that discovery is upfront. There's a lot of analysis. There's usually the authoring of documents with titles like software requirements specification or functional requirements. And then once that's done, you know, the dominant sort of metaphor in waterfall is that you're like in a boat and you go over the waterfall. And once you go over the waterfall, there's no going back. You've got to get your planning right up front and then execute. And there are projects, I think, that are well suited to waterfall, you know, that actually can work better with waterfall than with Agile. But for the most part, web development, especially front and user facing web development, usually works better with the Agile process.
I was going to say that there's a bit of a transition that I've seen, though, and in that a lot of large corporations who traditionally do everything waterfall, including, you know, when they get to their software, are transitioning to understanding what Agile is, and I think they're seeing the advantages and they're wanting to go Agile, but they end up structuring their contracts in a waterfall manner. And that has, I've just noticed, has caused quite a lot of pain points as well. Mostly
yeah, legal
for
hasn't
the shop.
Gotten the memo yet that Agile is a viable way to do business.
And I would argue that when you're looking at any process, it's not purely Agile or purely waterfall. I think that I think it's all shades of gray, where groups of developers and companies end up defining their own process that is likely to integrate elements of all manner of different project management styles, and. You know, for example, you may do all of your planning up front because you need to have a pretty accurate estimate. But then when you get to the development process, you may decide that you're going to do it in 2 week sprints and follow a Scrum methodology for those two week sprints. So I don't think that it's black and white. I don't think it's either or. I think that you can integrate elements from both methodologies and have really good, strong success.
Yeah, I think in my experience and just from, you know, talking to people and just sort of how I understand, I mean, when you're talking about project management's about, you know, well, getting the project done, and but about communication. You know, when it comes to project management, it's all about finding what works best to get the project done with the team that you have, and finding where those places are, which a lot of times means like working with people, communicating with people a lot, and really figuring out like where things really stick for people, and where you can keep things moving along. And if that means that you have to step outside the formal definition or boundary of XYZ project management style, you know, that's okay, and that's what you should do, and that's the decisions that you should be making, in my opinion. So I agree with you that there's a lot of gray area in there.
Yeah, we're talking about Agile versus Waterfall. At the end of the day, it comes down to trust. The Agile methodology requires the enterprise, and this is not just about trust between teammates. This is trust from the CEO's office on down. Essentially, they're ceding authority down to the level of the team, down to the level of the developer and the QA analyst and the UX designer, and they're saying, whatever you think is best, because you guys are the experts. And that can be, it can be impossible for some businesses, and quite honestly, some industries, to do successfully. That's just the way it is.
Yep. All right, so I have one last main thing to touch on, and then we're going to take some community questions. But so we have on Drupalize Me, we have this suggestion box where people can suggest topics that they want to see new videos on, and then vote up and down and that kind of a thing. So, and one of the things that it's been really interesting for me to see, you know, we have lots of topics, like, you know, that's why we have the Omega video series, say, right? But right now, number 11 on our list, and it's quite a large list with a lot of voting on it, number 11 is project management for large Drupal projects, which I guess, like, I found sort of surprising, because it's not like a how do I click this module together thing. But it seems like it's, you know, quite a need, and people want to get more information and more direction. And so I'm curious, I'm imagining that we will be doing a video series on that sometime in the first half of 2013. But we certainly don't have that yet, and we won't for the time being. So I'm curious, like, what sort of workshops or courses or books have you guys used, if you've used any, and do you have recommendations for where people can go and learn more?
There, the place to start, for sure, there are two organizations. We were talking about traditional project management, like Waterfall project management, and Agile methodologies. For a more traditional side, there's an organization called the Project Management Institute. And those are the people who support a professional certification called the PMP, the Project Management Professional. And on the other side, on the Agile side, there's an organization called the Scrum Alliance. And they're the people who essentially created Agile as we know it now, but it's become so many different things. And both of them have websites, and there's just tons and tons of information there.
On the book front, I would say for me, there's sort of two classics that I think of first and foremost for the two different methodologies. Scott Berkin's book, it used to be called The Art of Project Management, and he's now reissued it as a book called Making Things Happen, is my sort of, was my Bible for Waterfall, still is. It's a great book. He's not married to a methodology necessarily, but he's also cognizant of sort of the fact that project management is a thing that's been happening, you know, for centuries and centuries, since the Egyptians were, you know, building pyramids. Obviously, that was a different style of project management then. But anyway, that's a great book. Another one is Mike Cohn. He wrote a book called User Stories Applied, which I find to be sort of the best intro or avenue into Agile methodology. It sort of speaks to Scrum specifically and user stories as a tool for eliciting requirements, but he also gives a great overview of philosophically what Agile is and why Agile is. And then I would put in a third plug for a short book, which is free online, from 37 Signals, that was sort of written collectively over there. They were a Ruby on Rails shop, and now they are a products company that puts out things like Basecamp and HiRise. But their book, Getting Real, which really is a great insight into what some people call cowboy or, you know, minimum viable process or lean, agile, or, you know, there's different terms floating around out there. But the idea is that the rubber meets the road when you actually start building things, and that with software, it is unique in the great history of the world. And sometimes it's better to start building than it is to invest in planning. So those are three great resources.
I have one more book I'd want to toss in. It's an old book. You can still get it through Amazon. I've gifted it probably a dozen times to new project managers. It's called Making It Happen by Mackenzie Kyle. And the reason it's great is project management literature tends to be pretty dry. What Kyle tried to do with this book is take project management education and put it in a narrative context. So it's essentially a novel. It reads like a novel, but he's trying to teach and justify the need for project management. So that's kind of a soft shoe entree into the body of thought. It's a good book.
Some of my favorites are Agile and Iterative Development, A Manager's Guide. It's by a guy named Craig Larman. And he's got a whole section in that book, which is justification of agile methodologies, and that one chapter is well worth the price of the entire book. But he goes through all the different agile methodologies and gives you a good sense of the different tools and the different skills that you need to engage in. One of my favorite books, which I read, It's gone through many, many different revisions, but the Harvard Business Review on Managing Projects is really dry, but it's also a quick read, and it's awesome. And you know, this is going to sound a little trite maybe, but if you're really just starting out, I would recommend going to the library and picking up Project Management for Dummies. It's a quick, easy thumb through, and it'll give you an overview of pretty much all the different project management methodologies, and isn't hard to read. And finally, you know, there's no replacement for practice. A lot of what I do, I learned from other people by being a practitioner for the last 15 years. So I think that it's really a good idea, if you can, to marry yourself with other like-minded people, create a little support group, have a meetup with different folks that are doing project management in different shops in your local community. Spend time talking to each other, cross-pollinating and learning from each other.
And just as a quick plug, if you are into Drupal and you are into project management, there is a group for Drupal project management on groups.drupal.org. And there's an IRC chat room, Drupal-PM.
Awesome. Yeah, I'll put links to all of that stuff, really good stuff. I'll put all of that in the podcast notes. So there'll be a nice big clickable link list of good stuff to go check out. So let's wrap up with the community questions. We got two questions. I'm going to wreck his name, I'm sure, on Twitter. It's at Aldebir, I think. Aldebir Morales. And so his first question is, what artifacts should be made to a Drupal project? And what's an artifact? And does anybody have thoughts on the answer to that question?
This is a classic question, because one of the major differentiators between the waterfall methodology and the agile methodology, and I thought that Seth did a really good job of articulating this earlier, is that waterfall's heavy, heavy with documentation. And to my mind, when we talk about artifacts, that's really what we're talking about. We're talking about things that represent the stuff we're going to build for you. And those representations can be words, they can be pictures, they can be sometimes prototypes. That's what those artifacts are. And Waterfall depends tremendously on having those artifacts available so that the stakeholders can see them, approve them, give them a thumbs up, and say, okay, I authorize you to go spend my money to go build them. And one of the things that Agile says from the get-go is, let's not build too many artifacts anymore. Wouldn't we rather invest our time and your valuable money in actually building the project instead?
Right. And so in terms of like a Drupal project per se, it's more about methodology than it is the project itself.
I really think it is.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know whether I 100% agree with that. And the reason that I say that is that there's nothing better in terms of working with a client than putting together some wireframes quickly, so they have a sense of structure and they have a sense of what's going to be on a page, and it allows you to really get your head around how you might build something. And those wireframes might actually consist partially of screenshots from stock Drupal modules, so the client can take a look at what that 80% of what the feature set is that they can get by using the module, or it might even be putting it into a stock install and just showing them what it is that they're going to what it is that you'd like to use. But I do think that it's important, even in Agile, to have a certain number of artifacts up front. It's important to have basic wireframes. It's important to have some design up front. And I would argue that the user stories or use cases that you're using to develop from are also artifacts that are essential to having an effective sprint. So I'm not sure that that answers what artifacts do you need for a Drupal project, but I think that whether you're working in Drupal or whether you're working in Ruby or whether you're working in WordPress or whether you're doing custom development of some kind, having some level of artifacts so people are on the same page as to what they're building and how they're going about it is pretty important, and it could be as quick as a whiteboard sketch as well, to be honest. But I do think that you need to take a look at the particular project. You need to take a look at the particular client or your stakeholders and gauge the level of comfort that they're going to have in greater or lesser number of artifacts to support the development of the feature.
All right, and then the second question that we have is PMI, which is referring back to Project Management Institute Drew mentioned, says PMI is recommended to apply in a Drupal project, or is it too heavy? What do you recommend? And so I guess this is sort of almost kind of coming back to that waterfall versus agile kind of conversation again.
Well, you know, I can say from my standpoint, my training in technical theater is what really has defined how I manage projects and how I communicate with stakeholders. And I think that PMI is awesome. I don't have any bones against it at all. In fact, have bandied about with the idea of taking classes and getting my PMP. But that said, I don't think that it's necessary. If you've got certain soft and hard skills up front, I think that we discussed those a little bit earlier in the podcast. If you've got a certain set of skills in terms of planning and in terms of being able to communicate and translate, those are the critical elements. The training, I think, helps solidify all of that, but I'm not sure it's necessary. I think that it really comes down to the experience of the person who's doing the project management.
I agree with Matt. We talk about, he said earlier, I think it was Matt, that there's no black and white, you're agile or you're waterfall. We talk here about the fact that our methodology is wagile, It's agile with just enough waterfall to kind of keep things on the rails and keep the stakeholders as informed as they want to be. So, you know, it's kind of a wagile world, and it depends upon the needs of your team and your stakeholders and the products that you're building. Either one can work for you.
Right on.
Oh, man, that was good. Wagile world. I can't. I'm just.
I practiced that in front of the mirror this morning.
He's like, I know I'm going to say it. I'm going to use this one. Awesome. Well, we need to wrap things up. I want to mention real quickly here in closing that if you have questions about this podcast or suggestions for future podcasts, please let us know. Talk to us. We're here for you, dear listeners. And you can get in touch with us on Twitter, twitter.com/DrupalizeMe. Facebook, same thing, facebook.com/DrupalizeMe. Or you can use our contact form at drupalize.me/contact. Let us know what's on your mind. Thanks a lot, guys. I think this was a really great conversation, and I really appreciate your time to come on the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks, Addy. It's been a pleasure.
Woohoo!
Yeah. All right. Thanks a lot, guys, and we will talk to you next time. Everybody have a good time in Drupal land.